You are listening to Baseball Zealot Radio.
Okay, welcome to Baseball Zealot Radio. My name is Tom Nelsop, and I'm coming to you from Urbana, Illinois. This is show 27, and it's August 11th, 2007. Today we got a really great show today. We have Dr. Adrian Burgos. He's a University of Illinois professor, professor of history, and he's also an author and the author of the book Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Carter Line. And I thought we had him on, talk a little bit about the book, talk a little bit about the subject of Latinos, their role in baseball history. So welcome to the show, Adrian.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So give us a brief summary of the book. What exactly are you covering in Playing America's Game?
Well, what I try to capture is the story of Latinos in baseball in the United States headed back into the 19th century. And what really motivated the study, I've been a lifelong baseball fan. I played high school ball. I played Division III college ball. And as a history major at the small liberal arts college in New York called Vassar College, all history majors were required to write a senior thesis, and I decided to do one on baseball. And from there, looking at the baseball's introduction to the Caribbean, I learned something that really blew my mind away, and that was that the majority of Latinos who had played baseball during the segregated era actually played in the Negro Leagues. And as a lifelong baseball fan, I was just like, how come I've never heard of this?
Right.
It's written on this, and really, I wanted to know this story. In part, my historical curiosity was that, what explains this? Why is it that most Latinos played in the Negro Leagues? How were they treated? How were they received? What
sure.
was their experience on either side of the racial divide? And on the other hand, as a Latino who was studying this history, my family's background, my family history, I was like, why isn't it this story of Latinos in the Negro Leagues doesn't retain as much currency or memory among Latinos? So I really wanted to explore those issues.
Okay, yeah, but at the same time, if I remember correctly, there are the occasional Latino who did play in the bigs that were passed off, so to speak, as white. Is that correct?
Well, the way I found it in looking at this more closely, I was uncomfortable with the line that many people gave saying, well, the Latinos who got into major leagues were all white.
Yeah,
what I found in actually looking at the story of race in baseball was that baseball actually developed a quite sophisticated system of categorizing players.
Uh-huh.
And in that, they used categories such as yellow, brown,
right.
black, white, and red.
Sure.
And in some instances, they began talking about these racial categories before players were actually stepping into the major leagues. So, to me, that spoke to the ways that there was a system in place already, and it was about where do we place Latinos onto this color line, and that it was an active process in which players who were acceptable in the 19-teens, which were primarily lighter-skinned Cubans, and players who were unacceptable, that is, mulatto types or mixed-race
sure.
Cubans, by the 1940s, some of them were actually acceptable in the Major League circuit, to allowed them to play Major League Baseball.
Huh.
And so, again, it was like, well, what explains that? And what I found was that these individuals inside of baseball, that by baseball here I'm referring to organized baseball,
right.
such as Frank Bancroft from the business manager of the Cincinnati Reds,
right.
yeah, John McGraw's of the world, and others actually brokered access for Latinos to get into Major League Baseball. And by brokering, what I'm saying is that these players, if they by themselves claimed, well, I'm not black, it wasn't enough to get them into Major League Baseball. But if John McGraw said
yeah.
that
yeah.
Roberto Estrella is not black, or if Frank Bancroft said that that Armando Marzán or Rafael Almeida
sure.
are not black, then they get in.
Right.
And that makes all the difference. And in the academic world, where the focus has often been on passing, that is, an individual trying to pass off as a different racial identity, here we have a story of individuals from within a segregated institution brokering access to allow individuals to come into the circuit itself, but not as white, but as not black. And I think that's one of the major arguments that the book makes that should, I think, will hopefully catch on, to notice that the ways that the color line was about keeping out those who were seen as black, and specifically it was aimed at keeping out African Americans.
So it wasn't a color issue. It was more, well, I guess it was a color issue, but it was an issue of basically keeping out anyone who was not white. It was more anyone who was black.
In the end, that's the most
that's
enduring
essentially what
aspect.
It was.
Okay. Yeah, the most enduring aspect of the color line was keeping out black and keeping out African Americans.
What was the thinking behind that at, you know, in that period of time?
Well, I think two things. One was that there was an economic angle,
uh-huh.
And that is when we saw the first American Indian, Louis Sakalakis, come into the game,
right.
in 1897. He was seen as a drawing card. He was an attraction. People came to see him, and so it boosted the gate. Fans would come out to see this Indian ball player, and similarly, we saw at various moments when even the case of the very first Latino to break into base the major leagues, or the National League more specifically, Vincent Nava.
Okay.
The Providence Board of Directors actually met before they signed him, and one of the board members says, "I think he'll be a curiosity. He's going to be a drawing card." And that's why they brought him in. And here's the funny thing about Nava's story. He had taken on the name of his stepfather, his adoptive father, when he started playing in California. And he appeared in California, the California League, for three seasons as Vincent Irwin.
Oh, really?
But when he started to play with Providence, or even before he started to play with Providence, the team management itself says, "We want you to take back your blood name or your birth name. We want you to be Nava."
Right.
And so he appeared.
So it was almost like a novelty. You know,
exactly. He became a novelty, and that's where drew fans throughout the New England to come see Providence play.
Really?
And you would see in the newspaper that they marked the, they noted the transition from Don Irwin to Don Nava. And this, you know, and they called him the Spanish catcher of the Providence Club. There was even Sullivan, I'm forgetting, there was a parody song that was made and printed out in a number of newspapers talking about the Spanish catcher of the Providence Club. And so that fans knew, even if they never saw Vincent Nava actually perform, that there was someone who was not white like them,
right.
in the major leagues. It was this Spanish catcher. There was an economic angle, even when, actually in the 19th century it was about bringing in extra fans. In the 20th century, when we see the Cincinnati Reds and the Washington Senators go down to Cuba and Latin America and bring in players, the turn to Latin America was about bringing in talented players cheaply. And that was the cause,
sure.
for really the Washington Senators to become entirely dependent on, you know, their bottom line, their financial ledger was balanced on the backs of young Cuban prospects, whether or not they made it.
Right.
They would sign them for $75, which basically was the transportation cost of getting them from Havana to Washington Senators tryout camp.
Huh.
And they had nothing else to offer them. Joe Cambria, who was the Washington Senators scout in Cuba, he says, I give these guys a shot. That's all I promise them.
Sure, sure. You know,
that they have a chance to make the team. And so that's what the Senators did, and they signed players like Roberto Estrella and Roberto Ortiz and a number of other players. And actually, their Cuban connection wouldn't really make its biggest impact until after the Senators moved to Minnesota, where you saw players like Tony Oliva and Zola Versailles,
right.
Become stars of that Minnesota Twins team that went to the World Series.
That's almost ironic because the owner Griffith of the Twins was known for not bringing on African Americans onto the Twins team for the longest time. It's almost ironic in a certain way.
Right. Well, Clark Griffith has a very fascinating place in this whole story of Latinos in baseball, in that he was the manager of the 1911 Cincinnati Reds, which was when Rafael Almeida and Armando Bassanz became the first two Cubans to play in the 20th century. Well, after that season, the Reds let Clark Griffith go as their manager.
Uh-huh.
And Griffith actually pulled together some friends and resources and became president of a concern that, he was hired by about 10 years. He became the manager. The Senators hired him to be a manager, and later he ends up forming a group that buys out the Washington Senators.
Right.
But in 1912, when Marsans and Almeida get in a contract dispute with the Cincinnati Reds, Griffith put in feelers to say, trade them to me. Let them play with me here on the Senators.
Huh.
So he expressed a very early interest in keeping a connection.
That's real interesting, yeah.
Yeah. And what this is one of the fascinating things about the story of Latinos in baseball is that you see a couple of recurring actors in this story. I mentioned to you earlier about Frank Bancroft being the business manager of the Cincinnati Reds, who saw Rafael Almeida and Wander Marsans playing in Cuba. And I was one of the wonderful things about doing research here is I was in the Baseball Hall of Fame archives, and I came across a handwritten letter on the stationery from the Havana Hotel, dated December 26th, so it was shortly after Christmas. Bancroft was writing to the owner, Gary Herman, and was saying about he just spotted this ball player, Rafael Almeida, who's a great ball player. He is not black. He's quite a corker, so he's quite a good hitter.
Uh-huh.
So, and that we should sign him. And that he had played in the Connecticut League before, and that's what set in motion what would culminate 2 years later in Almeida and Marsans both appearing with the Cincinnati Reds. Well, the fascinating thing about Frank Bancroft is that he was the first North American team manager to bring a high-level set of professional players down to Cuba in 1879.
Wow.
So over 30 years earlier, he had, about 30 years earlier, he had brought this first group of North American professionals down to Cuba. Also, in 1883, he became manager of the Providence Braves, so he was also Vincent Nava's manager in Providence.
Oh, man.
So, and what I found, and I think both individuals like Bancroft and McGraw and Griffith and Joe Cambria, what I found is that these men were participating in a circuit of exchange. That Cambria, the super scout for the Washington Senators,
right,
had first learned about these Cuban players when he was owner of a Negro League team called the Baltimore Black Sox. And he established a friendship, or at least a professional relationship, with Alex Pompey,
okay,
who was owner of the New York Cubans and also the Cuban Stars baseball team. And so that there was these long threads of history of these individuals being involved with the Latin American and Latino baseball scene.
Wow. Now, just to switch gears real quick, you were on the committee that was real instrumental in choosing the Negro League Hall of Famers in 2006. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That's pretty amazing. That's quite a charge, I would think.
Yeah, well, it was a tremendous charge. I never knew when I started doing that research as a college senior on Latinos in baseball, that the Hall of Fame would tap me on the shoulder to serve on both the screening committee and the voting committee for this election.
How did you find out that you were going to be doing that? Did they send you an email? Did they give you a good call? How did they ask you? That would be quite an honor, I would think.
Indeed. I was part of a research group that had been put together when Major League Baseball underwrote a study on the presence of African Americans, or the history of African Americans in baseball, and it was through the Hall of Fame that groups were sent. There was a request for proposals to be sent, and so I was on this the research team that was given the grant to do this 3-year-long historical study of the Negro Leagues and African Americans in baseball in the long durée. And it was through there that the Hall of Fame became familiar with my work studying Latinos in the Negro Leagues and Latinos in baseball as a whole. I had done previously, I'd been to the Hall of Fame numerous times as a researcher, but this really got to see my work and the seriousness of the work there and the thoroughness of the work. And when they were putting together, and I give the Hall of Fame a lot of credit for this, because it showed a tremendous shift in kind of thinking about the story of black baseball, that when they put together a committee, a voting committee and a screening committee on the Negro Leagues, they said we had to have an expert on the presence of black players in Latin America and the presence of Latinos in the Negro Leagues. And they chose me to be one of those individuals with that expertise to serve on those committees. And for me, one of the important things about that is that it showed a historical awareness and sophistication of what the story of the Negro Leagues truly is. Because for me, one of the more fascinating things I found out in doing the research and meeting many of these men who played in Latin America coming out of the United States, African-American players, was there was a history of common struggles that was forged on the other side of the color line, on the other side of that racial barrier that had
sure.
been erected.
Uh-huh.
And that many of these players spoke very highly and fondly of the time they spent in Latin America, because for many of them it was the first time as professionals that they were allowed to play integrated baseball and treated as equals.
Mm-hmm.
And the significance of that is when I say treated as equals, I'm talking about they were paid regardless of their skin color, regardless of their citizenship.
Sure.
They were paid for their talent, not for the color of their skin.
Right.
And the Negro Leagues was, you know, a differently capitalized project than organized baseball.
Right.
You would have star players in the Negro Leagues, not the Hall of Fame tier players, but star players who would be receiving the equivalent of a double-A or an A-ball minor leaguer.
Right.
Because it just wasn't the same kind of financial structured that there in Negro League baseball than it was in the major leagues. But when they went down to Mexico to play in the summer league, for example, starting in 1938, they were paid like big league players. And guys like Ray Dandridge, Monty Irvin, Hilton Smith, and others would headed down at various times to Mexico because they were treated like the professional, talented players that they truly were.
Right, sure.
And it was quite liberating. But many of these players spoke of that time there, but also of the players who came out of Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Dominican, Venezuela, and Mexico to play in the Negro Leagues, and about their experience there. And I think it's a very important story that has too often been slighted within the overall story of the Negro Leagues. And in part, it has been because of language. That is, many of the first generation of Negro League historians, both academic and public or popular historians, didn't have the bilingual capability themselves.
Sure,
so they were trying to get to the Rudy Fernandezes of the world and Miguelito Navajos, these Negro League players who came out of Puerto Rico or Cuba.
Uh-huh.
But they just didn't have the language ability to interview them in Spanish.
Sure.
And I was fortunate enough to be bilingual and to be
yeah.
around when some of these ball players were still alive. Rudy Fernandez has died a number of years ago, but Miguelito Navajo is one of the pride of Puerto Rico. He's 102 years old,
and
he is the oldest living Negro Leaguer now. And I got to interview both of those guys.
Oh, did you really? Oh,
and
it must be fantastic.
And it was for them. You know, I translated their quotes in my various published works, but you know, it's just their ability to tell the stories in their native tongue liberated them. And all the stories they had to share, you know, it was
amazing. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
And I felt, you know, I felt tremendous pride in being able to, you know, build on the work of the Bob Petersons and the Jim Rileys and
mm-hmm.
the John Hallways and John Coates, who were that first group who began to recover the history of the Negro Leagues, you know, to build on their work and to go a bit beyond it in being able to go back to some of these players or reach players that they had never been able to interview and talk to them in their native tongue and let them speak in the language in which they could best speak and articulate their stories and I have interviews that lasted 7 hours, and they just kept going and going.
Sure, it
was a wonderful part of the experience.
We're talking to Dr. Adrian Burgos. He's a professor of history at the University of Illinois. He's also an author. His latest book is Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line. Speaking of, what would be the best way to get this book, Dr. Burgos?
Well, there's a number of ways. One, you can go onto the University of California Press's website, and you can order it through there. For those who are thrifty, they might want to just scoot over to Amazon.com. and you can also, if you live in the Champaign-Urbana area, head over to Pages for All Ages or the Borders or Barnes & Nobles and pick up a copy.
Uh-huh.
I will be at the Illini Union Bookstore September 19th to deliver a book talk and sign some books. So if folks are in the area.
Yeah, I think I'll stop by for that. We'll post a posting when that happens, before that happens. So anyone who checks out the baseballzealot.com, you can we'll remind you of that. That sounds good. Maybe we'll get some people over there and to take a look. A couple of quick questions. These will be rapid fire. Who's your personal favorite Latino baseball player all time?
This is actually a hard one. My favorite is Roberto Clemente, followed very, very closely by Manny Munoso.
Okay. How about Negro League player?
Well, you see, Martin Diego would probably be the top one there.
Yeah, okay. I ask this of every guest I have, pretty much. Do you follow a certain Major League Baseball team, and what is it?
You see, now you have to expose me to the world. I'm one of those people who roots for the evil empire called the New York Yankees.
No, oh no. That's okay. We have a co-host on this show who also does, so you're forgiven.
Yeah. I mean, there's biographical and geographical reasons for that. I was born in the Bronx, right down the street from Yankee Stadium at Bronx Lebanon Hospital.
Right.
Once my family moved out of the New York area, of all places that we resettled, it was to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where the Yankees were doing spring training at the time.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, as a ball player in high school, I did have the great, great opportunity and I reflect on it quite fondly that I played at Little Yankee Stadium in right field where Reggie Jackson and later Dave Winfield and, you know, all those Yankees had done spring training. I got to step on the field and, you know, it was in my high school baseball team uniform, but I played out there. I was out there.
So what do you think the Yankees' chances are this year for even making the wild card or anything?
Well, I think they have a pretty good shot at the wild card, but they just don't have the pitching.
No.
And I think that it's in fact teams, you know, it's going to be, they have enough offense to make it in, but they don't have the pitching to get through. And
right.
Even a team like the Tigers and the Indians who are they competing with right now, for the wild card, the Tigers and Indians are much more poised to make a bigger scene in the playoffs
because
they have better pitching.
No, I would agree with you on that. With
everything
you said,
the Yankees are built to clobber teams, but when you get to
game after game, I agree.
Right.
They would not last in a Flyers on game series. Yeah.
That's been their problem the last several years. You know,
right.
And, of course, you know, I think George is getting close to retiring at some point.
You think
so? Well, I think so,
think he might, yeah.
But the thing is that I think their biggest mistakes of late have been is instead of getting younger through free agency, they keep signing and trading for older players.
Older guys, yeah.
You know, and they break down.
Right. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. Is there anything else you want to mention before we let you go?
Yeah, one of the things that I've been working on of late and trying to do is educate more people about the case of Manny Munoso. And I was one of those who really advocated for his induction into the Hall of Fame.
You're not alone. I know that.
And one of those things is that here we have the player who was the first black Latino acknowledged to play in the major leagues with his debut in 1949 with the Cleveland Indians.
Sure.
And also he was, as many of us know, the first black player to star in Chicago playing with the Chicago White Sox.
I have a lot of White Sox fans, so they're definitely Minoso fans.
Yeah, well, one of the things that really disturbed me or distressed me this year was I picked up one of those. It's the 60th anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking the color line.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And there was a book that came out, published by Cal Sussman, called After Jackie.
Uh-huh.
And in this book, he refers to Ernie Banks as the first black player to star in Chicago.
Oh, really?
And I was like, wait a second. You know, 60 years after Jackie Robinson, why were you racing to what Minnie Minoso went through? You know,
right.
There, he was in his third full season in the major leagues when when Banks made that the end of season cup of coffee with the Cubs. But more significantly, Minoso had to take on all that heat. And really, for me, I think one of the things that his Hall of Fame, and this is also relates back to my experience serving on the Negro League special election, was part of our charge and historically. The way that the Hall of Fame has positioned the election of players is you're either a Negro League player, and you must be counted in on that category.
Yeah, I see what you mean, yeah.
Or you're a Major League player.
Right.
And the people that get most penalized by that system are the players like Minoso who were part of the integration generation.
Right, right.
The players who broke, you know, who helped us get through this period in which, America was dealing with the reality of race, it was perhaps the most difficult years.
Sure.
Coming out of World War II, where we won the war, but then realized that the war at home was just beginning, the war to secure rights for all Americans.
Right.
And Minoso was in the middle of that. And not only that, but he was not from the United States and therefore did not know English and was dealing with the difficulties of race in a differently speaking society.
Right.
And for some people, they said, well, that shielded him. Well, you speak with many in his private moments, he will let you know that, well, it wasn't really a shield. The N-word stings in any language.
It does.
And being hit with a baseball as often as many did also hurt quite a bit. And, the pitchers weren't on the mound saying, Minnie, you Cuban or you black? They're like, there's a black man there. I'm not quite sure he can handle this, so I'm going to throw at him a couple times and see, does he have the courage to get through all of it? So I think we have minimized his historical role as that first black Latino pioneer to really make a name for himself. And he was not only that, but he was great.
The guy
was a super player.
He was a great
player. Hall of Fame caliber player. And I think, when you put the entirety of his career into focus, 3 years in the Negro Leagues, twice an All-Star, years he spent in the Cleveland organization, we lose sight of how slow integration occurred. On a recent piece that I've written, which it's actually going to appear in the program guide for the Chicago White Sox, I call it Latino Pioneer Still Awaits Cooperstown's Call, and in it I talk about Minoso hit the integration ceiling, and that is teams were quite hesitant to have more non-white players in their starting lineup than white players.
Right, okay.
So the Dodgers as talented a group of black players, the Cleveland Indians as talented a group of black and Latino players that they had, players who are black and Latino, like Minoso, like Dobie, like Harry Sue Kate Simpson, they were not just competing for a spot on the team against all those who played the same position. They also competed with one another. And so Minoso had to be better than Satchel Paige, had to be better than Larry Doby just to get onto the roster.
I never actually thought of it in that way, but you're right.
And I think, people often use the traditional criteria that, he's playing in San Diego in the Pacific Coast League, he must not be good enough to be a major leaguer.
Right.
No, it's not. It wasn't that. He had the ironic misfortune of having been sold from the New York Cubans to one of the teams that was the most aggressive to pursue black and Latino players.
Right.
And if the Senators, the Yankees, the Red Sox, and all those other teams had really embraced integration much more quickly, Benoso could have appeared with another team much earlier.
Right.
And even you think about the White Sox. They actually had to trade to get their first major league black player.
Right.
So again, it tells you something about, you know, the pace of integration. And I truly believe that here's a historical figure who gets lost because of
sure.
the eligibility criteria that's created. It's not, you know, it's not God set down. It's like, these are the rules you must live by. These were criteria created prior to we really began to recover the history of the Negro Leagues. But what it leaves out is that generation of integration pioneers.
Right.
And we even see how hard it was for Larry Doby to be voted into the Hall of Fame.
Sure,
and he was
yeah.
the first guy in the American League,
American League,
star there. Yeah, and yesterday he was honored by the Cleveland Indians, but again,
How many years is that, that when they started actually recognizing him?
It's been like ten years when
they actually started mentioning the fact that, you know, that he was the first one. And now finally, I actually saw that. I thought, what do you mean they're actually starting to recognize the fact that he was the first? It's a good grief. Cleveland Indians are finally starting to talk about it. It kind of blew my mind away that, you know, that.
Well, and I think it happened in a number of different ways.
Right.
New York City just had this, or still has this exhibit going on the 1947, and talks about all the New York City teams that had great seasons, the Dodgers and the Yankees
uh-huh.
and the Giants, but they had absolutely no coverage of the New York Cubans winning the Negro League World Series that
yeah.
year.
That to me is surprising.
And they even talked about some of the semi-pro teams that were playing.
Right.
The Bushwicks out in Brooklyn, but it's like, whoa, what's going on here? It's still interesting the ways in which we remember history, even in the contemporary moment, how we forget very things that were actually more significant or given more recognition when it happened than we are given it today, which is kind of sad.
What strikes me is when you're talking about how black players back in that time would be almost have to compete against each other because teams would not want to have more black players and white players in a starting lineup. And so essentially, black players would have to essentially be in basically compete against each other, and that would almost go against, you know, the whole idea of like solidarity and the Negro Leagues and whatever. And it just seems like ironic in a way.
Yeah, I think integration of baseball is one of those, you know, for me, I actually taught a course at the university called Baseball and Integration where we studied a number of histories written about the Negro Leagues and the process of integrating baseball. There's this wonderful book that I think is one of the benchmark books about the integration of baseball by Jules Tigil called Baseball's Great Experiment. But there's also another very wonderful book called Shut Out, The Story of Race in Boston Baseball
uh-huh.
by Howard Bryant. And so my students read this, and they were just amazed to read, you know, how long a span of time it took to integrate baseball. It was 12 seasons before each major league team had at least one black player appear on their squad. And the ironic thing, and this is another very wonderful baseball book written by Brad Snyder,
uh-huh.
Beyond the Shadow of the Senators, and Brad talks about that Clark Griffith actually had a very close relationship with the owner of the Homestead/Washington Grays.
Oh, did he?
Called, his name was Composey.
Okay.
And Composey was recently elected into the Hall of Fame as part of the vote that we had last year. And what was interesting is Griffith defended the right of the Negro Leagues to exist and actually advocated for their continuation. But on the other hand, Griffith also made over $100,000 a year on the rentals that he gave out for the games he had in the Negro Leagues playing at Griffith Stadium. And so, you know, he had a financial interest, but he also was, I mean, he sincerely was a close friend of Composey.
Okay.
And so, again, we have this very almost, you know, paradigmatic figure in Clark Griffith because Griffith, although he had brought in a number of racially ambiguous Cubans onto his squad even before Robinson played with the Dodgers. Players in which some folks in Cuba say, well, you know, we know that his grandmother's black. You know, why we don't understand how he got into the major leagues.
Right.
What Griffith and other in the Washington Senators organization would say is, well, he's not black, he's Cuban. and that was, he was able to get, I think, do that because the Senators, for much of the 1940s and into the 1950s, were a rather weak team. The old saying was, first at war, first in peace, last in American League. That was the story of the Senators. And so Griffith, you know, had this relationship with Posey, and he actually did not support integration. The story I was telling was the first black player to play with the Senators was Carlos Paula, but it wasn't until 1955 or 56 that Joe Black, the old Dodgers pitcher, became the first African American to play with the Washington Senators, and he would only had a couple coffees at the tail end of his career.
Right.
So what's significant about this? Well, in that here you had a guy who was constantly bringing in players that raised the eyes of black and white, and with the color line here, he's living in Bobby Estrella.
Yeah.
But he was among the very last guys to bring in African-American players onto his own team.
Huh. Interesting. My next question is you is where were all these baseball classes when I went to the university? Integration of baseball and physics. Well, I tell you.
Yeah, it is a different world. It has taken, I think, even in my case, people really seeing the sport of baseball as another site to examine and understand things that we've looked at in other areas. I mean, it's fascinating. We have people studying music, but it's more difficult to get sport recognized as a critical site for understanding whether it's physics, whether it's history, anthropology, or sociology. So, yeah, it is fascinating that there are more opportunities there. When I first started doing this research, I presented at a conference. It was my first year in graduate school. I was in Philadelphia. And I told people, well, yeah, I'm writing this for my dissertation. And they said, oh, you'll never get a job with that. And I said, well, you know, I'm at the University of Illinois. We have we're top tier in history and top tier at an undergrad university. And, it was funny. People actually discouraged me from pursuing this.
Well, we've been talking to Dr. Edgar Burgos. He's a professor of history at University of Illinois. And he's... just came out with a book, Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line. Dr. Burgos, I want to thank you for being on the show. It's a fascinating topic. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about it, and I wish you good luck. I want to once again tell people that on September 19th, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, September 19th, there will be a talk at the Wanna Union bookstore, and Dr. Burgos will be signing books and talking about the book. If you're in the Champaign Urbana area, you know, please go on over there. Do you know the time right now?
It's going to be at 4 o'clock.
At 4 o'clock, and I'll post on thebaseballzealot.com closer to the date when that will be. But yeah, that sounds fun. I think I'm going to stop by.
Oh, that'd be great. We'll be there till at least 5:30. So
okay.
Yeah, you stop by. And Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about this, and
you
thank
too.
You for inviting me to appear on the show.
Oh, fantastic. Well, you take care, okay?
Take care, Tom.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
I'd like to thank Dr. Adrian Burgos from the University of Illinois for coming on to the show and talking about his latest book. If you're interested in checking it out, the name of the book is Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line. It is available on Amazon.com. If you're in the area, Champaign, Urbana area, that is, stop by Awana Union Bookstore or Pages for All Ages, and they should have it. There is the September 19th book signing, and he'll talk a little bit there too, so stop by. I think it'll be at 4 o'clock. That's it for our show. If you want to email us, give us any suggestions, comments, whatever, feel free to do that. Our email address is feedback@baseballzealotradio.com. Give us a call, leave a voicemail. Phone number is 217-883-4571. And on our website, if you want to check out our blog is www.thebaseballzealot.com. And I think that's it for today. Come back next week. We'll have another show. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.